This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
If to Yaakov and intended to give to Esav is the role of the food that was dished up to Yaakov, to Yitzchok, before he gave the brachas. Why is there so much emphasis on that meal, on that bit of meat which Yitzchok wanted to eat before he gave the bracha? What is its role? What is its purpose? We looked at it very briefly last night and gained some kind of insight as to the deeper meaning of what Yitzchok intended. And we noted certain similarities between the bringing of a sacrifice, the bringing of a korban, and that meal which Yitzchok required should be served to him before he gave the bracha out. Why did there have to be food altogether? Why did it have to be hunted? Why did it have to be game? Why couldn't it have been ordinary meat, which Esav could have bought at any Mahadrin butcher in the area? What is a korban? What is a sacrifice? On the one hand, we're not going to understand the philosophy of korbanos. The Rambam says in Hilchus Me'ilah, it's one of these things that we don't understand. It's something which the Olam is omed, it's something very primary and very central to the survival of the world. But we can't understand exactly why and exactly how. On the other hand, that same Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim gives a reason for korbanos, for which he's attacked vehemently by many others. He says, says the Rambam, that when Bnei Yisrael left Egypt, they had been severely influenced by the sacrificial practices of the Egyptian nation. And God, realizing that he wasn't going to be able to wean them from sacrifices altogether, substituted himself as the recipient of the sacrifices instead of the idols to which they were accustomed to worship, the Rambam says. And the Rambam is attacked left, right and center. Is that korbanos? A concession to their idolatry practices before? The whole of Vayikra is a concession to idolatry practices? You're going to do this kind of thing, you might as well do it for God rather than do it to something else. But there's nothing inherent in it. Is that what it means? So firstly, Chas v'Sholom, that should be the entire meaning of the sacrifice of mitzvahs in the Moreh Nevuchim. It's only a little spitzkele, it's one little aspect of the mitzvah. There's no way that the Rambam endeavors to explain or claims to explain all the reasons to the mitzvahs in the Moreh Nevuchim. Secondly, the Rambam himself says in the Yad HaChazokah that there's no way we can begin to understand the meaning of the sacrifices. So it's quite clear that it's a lot more complex than that. Be that as it may, the Telzerov claims quite rightly that the Rambam is unjustifiedly attacked on that issue, because there's a Medrash which says exactly the same. It's not the Rambam's own Chiddush. The Medrash is in Parshas Achrayimus. Rabbi Pinchas b'shem Rabbi Levi Omar, Moshol leben melech shegas libo yolov. It can be compared to a prince who's become coarse, and v'hoyolomed lechol boson leveilus utreifis. This prince started becoming accustomed to eating treif, much to the upset of his father. Omar HaMelech, so the king said, Zeyye todir al shulchoni. This prince, let him always sit at my table. It'll disappear. His tendency to eat treif will disappear. Let him always have supper with me. Let him have dinner with me, and he'll find all of a sudden he doesn't need to eat treif anymore. Kach, in the same way, says the Medrash, Nefisho Yisrael luhuti machar avidus kechovim b'mitzrayim. Since the Jewish people were intensely involved in idolatry in Egypt, and they used to bring sacrifices to all sorts of strange spirits, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Yiyu makrivim lefonai b'chol eis korbanoseim b'oil moed, let them rather bring their korbanos before me at all times in the Mishkan. V'hein nifroshim me'avedus kochovim, and automatically they will find themselves being weaned from idolatry. V'hein nitzulin, and they will be saved. The Medrash says it itself, that the korbanos were introduced to wean Bnei Yisrael away from Avodah Zarah. Strange thing. So if we're going to get upset with anybody, it's not the Rambam we've got to get upset with. It's the Medrash we've got to get upset with and endeavor to understand it. In order to understand korbanos, at least something, all we can do is understand a little bit, some little superficial aspect of it. We need to appreciate that the existence of material things and animal drives has been a source of embarrassment to the human race since the time of Adam. We like to consider ourselves as angelic, as spiritual, as superhuman, as a little bit godly. And every now and again, when we come down to earth again, it shocks us a little bit and it disappoints us. We spoke about laughter last week. Part of the elements of laughter are when somebody that you envisage as being very great, you suddenly see is very ordinary. So if you see a very dignified person in a bowler hat and a pinstripe suit walking down the road and slips on a banana peel, you laugh. It is an ordinary human being after all, subject to the forces of gravity like anybody else. It's funny. But that laughter is a laughter of embarrassment. It's a laughter of semi-disappointment. That after all, even he is subject to the normal rules of science. It is this sense of embarrassment which caused Adam and Chava to cover up their nakedness. It's this sense of embarrassment which causes us to act with tznius. What is tznius? We try to cover up the physical parts of ourselves and our lives. It's for that reason that you'll find in most civilized places bathrooms have doors and very often locks. It's for that reason that you'll find that when we eat, we try not to eat in a grob, coarse way. We try to make it civilized. We're constantly involved in an effort to civilize ourselves, to diminish the emphasis that we lay on the physical part of our lives. And our physical drives disturb us so often, worry us, are a source of concern. And it's been attempted to be handled in different ways by different sociologists and psychologists. But primarily, you land up, if you follow the schools of psychology, you land up with the attitude that some of them have adopted, that man is nothing but a social animal. We're driven by the same old drives, we want the same old things, we kill each other, we tear each other to pieces, we're jealous of one another. At the end of the day, what is it the psychologists and sociologists say? There's another animal, that's all. A slightly more sophisticated animal. And if one's going to pull oneself down to that level, then okay, then that's what you're going to deal with, the human being as animal. But if you insist on seeing the human being as spiritual, if you insist on seeing the human being as v'tachasriyu me'at me'ilukim, as a little less than God himself, what do you do with all these animal drives? What do you do with the fact that we are in a material world, that the majority of our days occupied in material things and in the fulfilling of material needs and desires? What are you going to do with that? We have to eat, we have to sleep, we have to relieve ourselves, all the animal things we have to do, and that's such a part of our existence. How do we cope with that? How do we handle that? And even worse, when that animal part of our existence starts dominating us, and it's even more troublesome and even more worrisome. And that applies not only in the secular world but also in the religious world, where you find religious people are dominated by their material drives, where ambition brings them to do things which aren't correct, where desire, selfishness, self-centeredness all bring people to do things which are not spiritual, which are not godly, and then you find them trying to justify it, but I'm doing it for a godly purpose. I'm doing it for a godly reason. So I can come and I can talk Lashon Hora about my friend's shul down the road, so that you should come to my shul, because after all I'm building a shul and that's the Shem Shamayim. And so we find ourselves doing things which are despicable, because we're driven by animal drives, and then we still have the chutzpah to dress it up in the Shem Shemayim. This is all for God that we're doing it. That means not only do we demote ourselves to the level of animals, but we try and pull the Ribbono Shel Olam down with us to that level. These are all very troubling things to a human being, and have been troubling to humanity, as I said, since the time of Adam HaRishon. The human race has been worried and troubled by these urges, by these needs, by this aspect of our existence which is so heavy and so predominant. It's been handled by different cultures in different ways. Primarily, the means of handling it is an effort to dominate it. And you find that expressed in many areas. You find it expressed, for example, in bullfighting. What's a bullfight? There's a lot of philosophy behind a bullfight. It's not just a piece of nonsense. A bullfight is the domination of man over animal. That's what it is. The ability to bring a wild ox under one's control and to submit him and to very precisely and coolly be able to stick a knife into his neck, and that's the end of him. That's man's attempt to demonstrate his ability to master the wild ox in him. Not just that wild ox, but the wild ox in life, the wild ox within oneself, the wild ox within humanity. The lion tamer in the circus, what's he all about? Not just entertainment, what kind of entertainment? Why does it thrill people to see it so much? Take a wild animal, a wilde chaya, and bring it under the control of one human being. But with a word, with a crack of a whip, he can get the lion to do what he wants. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to use that very example to show what the human being is capable of. If you can take a wild animal and you can submit him to that discipline, then there's no human being that can't discipline himself. There's no human being that can't become his own lion tamer and subject himself to that same mastery of the animal that the lion tamer can do in the circus ring. But there too we see the attempt of the human being to demonstrate his mastery over the animal. What is horse breeding, horse riding, horse racing? It's all part of the same thing, the human being dominating the animal, using the animal, directing the animal, mastering the animal. The conqueror, the explorer, the man who climbs Everest. What does he do it for? What does he need it for? A man needs to dominate nature. He needs to feel he's a balabos over nature. He needs to feel he can do it. And so he climbs Mount Everest. He goes to the North Pole, or he goes to the moon. Technology, science, it's all an effort on the part of the human being to dominate his environment, to dominate nature, and to dominate the world. That's the one way of handling it. Of course, one of the mistakes is that it's part of Western culture to emphasize the object rather than the subject. And so the lion tamer tames a lion, and the bullfighter fights with a bull, and the explorer climbs Mount Everest. Their own soul, which offers greater challenges than the lion or the bull or the mountain, that they don't attempt to tame, and that they don't attempt to master. But that's a flaw in Western civilization. There is a second means of handling this embarrassing physical aspect of our environments and of our lives, and that is the glorification of it. To build it into something glorious. For example, eating is an embarrassment. The fact that I need to eat, I consider myself eternal, powerful, potent, omnipotent. I have to sit down and eat, and when I get hungry I start getting irritable. What kind of God am I? So in fact the need to eat is an embarrassment for anybody who feels himself godly. So what have we done with food? We've glorified it. Look, you don't eat like an animal eats. You pay a couple of hundred rand to go and eat. You sit down in a restaurant, in a Mahadrin restaurant, but not where the food is, where only the food is Mahadrin, where the decor is Mahadrin, and the candles on the table are Mahadrin, and the tablecloths on the Mahadrim, and the cutlery and crockery is the finest and the best, and the glass is crystal, and you sit down in this hush atmosphere with an almost religious aura to it. You could be in some ancient temple, and the food is brought in magnificently as if as an offering, and placed before one, and the whole routine that goes with the serving up and with the dishing up, and the big day kahuna which the waiters wear, it's all a whole religious experience. What's it all about? Why are people willing to pay that kind of money to eat a good meal when very often their mother's cooking at home was 10 times better? What's the big deal? And they're willing to pay this kind of money. And if you go to these really fancy restaurants, they tell me, look at what they're eating, they get tiny little portions. Don't even get much for it. What's the big deal? It ceases to be an embarrassment. Food, the act of eating, has been glorified into a religious act. This is now something that's social, and it's religious, and it's meaningful, and it becomes a whole thing. The question is no longer the sophisticated, civilized way of deciding what you're going to do for dinner is not what are we going to eat. Because a civilized person doesn't care what he's going to eat. That's not the issue. Food's not important. The civilized question is, where shall we go for dinner this evening? To what temple shall we go this evening to take part in this special thing? Unfortunately, we have to eat while we're there. That's the avodah. You have to eat, so we'll go and we'll eat. But what we're going is we're going to a restaurant. We're not going to eat. It doesn't use such a word. That's course. We're going out to a restaurant. We're going out to dinner. To dinner. Not going to eat. To eat means I need it. I have to eat. No, dinner is an event. Like one goes to the theater, one goes to a concert, so one goes to dinner. Capital D. So we've made a whole religion out of it. The glorification of the physical. The building up of business into a religion. Of a career into a religion. Of a profession into a religion. That's part of the glorification of the material life that we live. In the religious sphere, the same occurs. In the Christian religion, primarily in the Catholic religion, the emphasis is the first one. The domination of the base drives and desires of the human being. You want to be a holy person? And the certain things you've got to cut out. You don't get married, don't drink wine, all sorts of pleasures you've got to give up. That's it. You dominate those drives by driving them out of your existence completely. The one attitude. And in the Eastern religions you find more of the second attitude, where there's a glorification of many of the pleasures of life. They've given the whole religious meaning all of their own. But there is a third method to handle the embarrassment which is caused by our physical environment and our material drives. And that's not domination and not glorification, but that's elevation. To elevate them. And that is something which is uniquely Jewish. There is no other religion, there is no other cultural civilization which is able to walk that narrow line between domination and glorification along the line of elevation. For the glorification of the material is avodah zarah. That is called idolatry. When you take something material and you make it a religion, you make it a god, that's idolatry. That's what avodah zarah is. This is my God. Look at him. There he is. That's avodah zarah. That we can't do. To practice the Catholic approach of totally annihilating the drives that we have, for that you've got to believe in the devil. You've got to believe that there's some negative power which was created against the will of God. But if you believe in the Achdus Hashem, in the oneness of God, and that there's only one Ribbono Shel Olam, who is Kulo Tov, and everything He made and everything He created is good and worthy and holy, how can you drive away certain ambitions, certain natural feelings which the human being has? Surely God put them there for Kedusha and not to be driven away? And so our theology requires that we reject the system of domination and that we reject the system of glorification, and leaves us only with one option. That is the option of elevation. You don't drive the drinking of wine out as if this is something not allowed. Nor do you glorify it into something which is an end in itself and get drunk and think that that's a holy way to spend one's time. One elevates it. One uses it for kiddush, for havdalah, for koshel broche. One elevates it. The principle of the korban is the principle of the elevation of the animal. We take the animal and we don't fight it in the ring and then put a spear into its neck and throw it out. We perform a korban, we perform a sacrifice, where we take the animal and we elevate it to the level of a korban, where the animal is brought right inside the Beis HaMikdash, where the animal is brought right inside to the holiest place in the world. You know it is the Beis HaMikdash. The din is that when you go today to the Kosel, when you first see the place where the Beis HaMikdash stood, you're required to perform the mitzvah of Kriya. You have to do like an oval, you have to tear your clothes. It's for many reasons, destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But there's another reason to do it also. Sometimes you stand there and you look at the tours which are being taken inside the place where the Beis HaMikdash stood, and you see the people who are going in. Apart from the halachic problems that we're not allowed to go in there at the moment, apart from that, the type of people who are walking over the Mokom Beis HaMikdash, the place where the Kohanim used to walk, where the Kohen Gadol used to walk, the place that was reserved for such kedusha, the place where the Kohen Gadol and the Kohanim used to wash their hands and feet and their bodies countless times before they went there, the place that you had to go to the mikveh and pour aduma before you could walk in there, the place where you had to have the right frame of mind and the right attitudes before you could walk in there, and you could only walk in there to perform an avodas Hashem. And here you've got these tourists dressed like goodness knows what, looking like goodness knows what, thinking of goodness knows what, walking and trampling all over the Mokom Beis HaMikdash, and one's going to stand there and sing and dance about how happy we are that we've got the Mokom Beis HaMikdash in our possession. Nothing to sing and dance about. The Kosel is a place to take Kriya. The Kosel is a place to cry at. They call it the Wailing Wall. And I've often mentioned that it's a little bit of a pity that they've spoilt the atmosphere by turning it into a big plaza there. It used to be a little corner, it used to be a little alleyway, and people used to come there and pour out their hearts. Now people come there and they sing and they dance. What are you singing and dancing for? What's so wonderful? That it's in our possession so that all these funny people can go walking over it? Is that what we're singing and dancing for? Who knows whether it wouldn't have been better, chas v'sholem, not in our possession? Who knows? What kind of thing is it to sing and dance for? But the animal we allow in, the bull, the ox, the lamb, he walks right into the Beis HaMikdash. Right? Not just into the Beis HaMikdash, onto the Mizbeach we put him. That we're prepared to do. We're prepared to take the animal and to elevate him, to make him special, to make him Kodesh. We're not going to banish him from the wall, from within the walls of the Beis HaMikdash. We're not going to say this is no place for an animal. We're going to say to come in here, oh, what an animal you need to be. What elevation, what purification you need to go through. But it is possible, even if you're an animal, to get right on top of the Mizbeach and to be taken right into the Mokom Beis HaMikdash, into the most central area of the Mokom Beis HaMikdash, and to become part of the Avodah, to become part of the service, even if you're just an animal. An animal can do that. That's the level to which we are capable of elevating an animal, and consequently the animal within us. We can do that, it can be done. That's a korban. And so we shecht the animal, we slaughter the animal, we dedicate it, we elevate it. It's eaten, it's consumed by the Kohanim, by the holy people in the Beis HaMikdash, in a special environment and the special conditions. And so the animal finds itself elevated to the highest levels possible. Then there are all sorts of Kabbalistic connections between that animal and all the animals. When one sacrifices one animal, one is in fact sacrificing the animal, capital T, capital A. The animal universally, the animal in the human being. That's already all sorts of Kabbalistic things. Now that we know that the human being is capable of spiritualizing the animal, for that's what a korban is. A korban is not killing the animal, but spiritualizing the animal. Then it is also possible to spiritualize the animal within us. Not to kill the animal within us, which is what the Catholics aim to do. Not to glorify the animal within us, which is what many idolatrous religions aim to do. But to elevate and spiritualize the animal within us. To turn the animal within us into something of kedusha, into something of sanctity. And when that's achieved, we have the Odom Kodosh, we have the holy man, which we made reference to last night as described in the Mesillas Yeshorim. When the Mesillas Yeshorim says, Hinei ha'ish ha'miskadesh b'kedushas boiroi, a man who is able to sanctify him with the sanctity of his Creator, afilu ma'isov ha'gashmim choizrim liyeh sinyonei kedusha mamash, even his physical actions become spiritual actions. There's no longer a barrier between the physical and the spiritual. And that's what we're really trying to reach. Those who practice domination try to remove the barrier between spiritual and physical by annihilating the physical. Those who practice glorification try and remove the barrier by making the physical something spiritual, making it something holy. We remove it by bridging that gap and creating a sanctity where physical and spiritual become synthesized. The simonecho achilas kodshim shehiatzmo mitzvasase. And the image, the picture, the proof of this, says the Mesillas Yeshorim, is the eating of kodshim. We use the word kodshim. A sacrifice is called kodshim, sanctity. And the mitzvah is to eat it. That's the mitzvah itself. There's nothing more physical than to eat. And there's nothing more full of sanctity than for the Kohanim to eat the kodshim, to eat the sacrifice. That physical act of eating becomes an act of kedusha, an act of sanctity. That shows the extent, says the Mesillas Yeshorim, to which a physical action can be spiritualized and elevated. The Yom Ruzal Kohanim Oichlim Uvailim Miskaprim. The Kohanim are sitting and eating, and what's happening to the owner of the korban, the person who sinned and did tshuva and brought a korban chatos, he brought a sin offering, and the sin offering is sacrificed on the mizbeach, on the altar, and then the kohanim sit down and they have a meal. What's happening while they're eating? God is busy forgiving the owner. The act of eating affects the forgiveness for the owner of the korban. Something so physical has an effect so very spiritual. That's kedusha, says the Mesillas Yeshorim. That's sanctity. When the most physical of all actions can have the most spiritual of all consequences. And so he develops the idea further, and he shows that a person who becomes a kodesh, v'hinei ish kazeh, a man such as this, v'nitza shal yedei zeh yotzi misug harashi b'chumrius v'nishorim tahirim at litzah kodush aloi bo. And such a man is himself considered like the Mishkan itself. The Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, was a physical building, built with bricks, with wood, with ordinary physical material. Yet it had absolute Kedusha. Sefer Torah. It's made with parchment, with ink, with physical things, a pair of tefillin. It's made with parchment, ink, has Kedusha. The material object is converted into an object of extreme sanctity. And these human beings become themselves in the same way, just as the Sefer Torah is a physical thing made from physical material, yet it has Kedusha, and when the ark is opened, everybody stands up, and when the Sefer Torah comes out, everybody bows and scrapes and kisses it, because they understand it's an object of Kedusha. Where's the Kedusha? It's a material object that's made from parchment, from animal skin. But we understand it has Kedusha. So the human being who is able to sanctify himself, he's like the tabernacle, like the temple, and like an altar. Because God's presence dwells upon them as obviously as it dwells upon the Mikdash itself. And therefore, the Mesilas Yesholim goes into his next level, into his next development, and he says that if a tzaddik who has reached the level of Kedusha consumes food, that has the same effect as a korban which has been brought, as a sacrifice which has been brought. That is an elevation too. Once a human being has become so synthesized with God and with godliness that he himself is like the Mizbeach or like the Mishkan, everything which becomes part of him becomes like a sacrifice and becomes like a korban. We explained last night, it's even more than that. If everything this man does is so holy and so great and so righteous, and if I give him food, I am energizing his righteousness and I am energizing his godliness. The food that I am giving him is converted to energy which is being consumed by a being who is totally godly. That's the closest one can come, kibayochel, so to say, to giving the Ribbono Shelom himself food, to feeding, to giving him koyach, to giving God strength. The closest one can come to that is to give a kodosh the koyach and the strength. And therefore it's said that in fact, kol amevi doirein l'talmid chochum ki'ilu hikriv bikurim, one who brings a gift to a talmid chochum, to a talmid chochum of this kind of stature, it's as if hikriv bikurim, as if he's brought the sacrifice of bikurim. He's given energy to the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say. His food, that which he's given, the gift he has given, has become is as if it was brought on an altar, as if it was brought as a korban. And therefore, the Telzer Rav explains the Medrash with which we started in the Rambam, that God says, "Let them bring sacrifices to me rather than to the idols." Telzer Rav explains that there is a natural, inherent drive in the human being to elevate the physical, to take the animal and to sacrifice it. There always has been, right from the time of Adam HaRishon, people have brought korbanos, and when they became idol worshippers, they carried on bringing korbanos. There's a natural desire to want to sacrifice, and bullfighting is a modern form of sacrificing, and lion taming is another form of sacrificing. These are all forms of taking the animal and mastering it and shechting it, and where possible, elevating it. The only thing, says God, is don't glorify the animal. Don't merely master and dominate the animal. Elevate the animal. Bring the animal right inside the Beis HaMikdash. Put him right on top of the Mizbeach. And dedicate him to things godly. And in that we have the understanding that the animal part of ourselves must not merely be dominated. It must not merely be mastered and driven out of ourselves. That's not what we're meant to do. The animal part of ourselves has to be brought onto the altar of Avodas Hashem and has to be elevated and dedicated to things holy and to things of Kedusha. And so Yitzchok wants Esau to bring a sacrifice before he gives him his bracha. He wants him to bring a korban, but not a korban on a regular altar. He wants the korban to be brought to himself, as we learned in the Mesilas Yesholim. You bring me the animal, I'll consume the animal, and my consumption of the animal will be as if you've brought a korban, and then I can give you a bracha. That gives us some understanding of what goes on, but not enough. So we still have to understand why he had to go hunting for the animal, and we still have to understand why the food had to be delicious. Esav doesn't just ask for food, he doesn't say just go out there and get me something to eat. Mat'amin kasher ohavti. Make me delicious food. You know exactly how to prepare it. You know what I like. You bring it to me and I'll eat it. You see that the taste, that the experience of eating it itself is important to Yitzchak in some strange way. We don't understand why. Yitzchak was already an old man, a tzaddik. Where do you find a man so old and so spiritual and yet so able to enjoy something so physical? Not just able to do it, but able to enjoy it, to do it with geschmack, to eat a good piece of game and enjoy it and savor the taste of it. What is it? Yitzchok wants to show Esav this very lesson. Don't think, Esav, that to become my successor, you are going to have to give up those drives, those ambitions which the Ribbono Shel Olam placed inside you. Don't think that becoming an Oved Hashem means in any way annihilating one's natural, or any aspect of one's natural drives and of one's natural needs and desires. And this is something fundamental and basic. I've often mentioned that the surreptitious way in which the Christian secular system of thinking filters right into ourselves from our environments is so worrying. When one sometimes listens to people speaking in matters Yiddishkeit, when one hears sometimes of people expressing their views, religious people, on being religious, one sometimes has to ask oneself, am I listening to a Catholic priest or am I listening to a Ben Tzur? Because the differences are so vast, and yet without even noticing it, one notices, if one looks, a tendency to become Catholic in one's religion. This view expressed by Yitzchok is so fundamental and so important. Don't think, says Yitzchok, that becoming an Oved Hashem means annihilating any drive that you have, any natural feeling that you have, any natural instinct or intuition that you have. Nothing has to be destroyed and nothing dare be annihilated. It must all be used for Avodas Hashem. Just as we discussed in the sacrifice and the korban, the purpose is not to master and annihilate the animal, but to elevate the animal. So with every animal part of your being, the purpose is not to annihilate and to destroy it, but to elevate it, says Yitzchok. And Yitzchok shows it to Yaakov, to Esav, in a real way. He says, bring me something to eat, Esav, but make sure it's delicious. I want to enjoy it, Esav. You? Yitzchok? An old man in his hundreds already? A tzaddik gomor? Ha'ovis heineina merkova? This is part of God Himself? And you're asking for a delicious dinner? Is that what's important to you in your old age? Not just that you want something to eat, but you want me to bring a sacrifice? Good. That you're going to consume the sacrifice? Okay, I understand that. But it must still be delicious, properly flavored, properly cooked, properly spiced. Yes. No drive, no ambition, no intuition, no feeling or instinct that the human being has been blessed with is meant to be destroyed. Chas v'shalom. And Yitzchok needs to show Esav that he too can enjoy a good meal, and more important, says the Ramban, not only can I enjoy the good meal, but the enjoyment of that meal is essential for me to reach the level of Ruach HaKodesh which I'm going to need in order to give you the blessing. I need to reach an even higher level of spirituality, and unless I have a delicious meal, I can't do it. Why not? A tzaddik has to have a delicious meal before he reaches a level of Kedusha and of Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah? What kind of business is this? I remember once in Yeshiva in Gateshead, there was a time when the food was really so bad that, in my opinion, it already became a question as to whether one was permitted to make a brocha on it. That you had to eat it, knew there was no choice. You were hungry and there was nothing else to eat it. There was no question that you had to eat it. My only shaila was whether you needed to make a brocha on it or not. And I discussed it with some of the senior boys in the yeshiva, and they said, Tamar, have you come to Gateshead to eat or to learn? So I felt a bit embarrassed and carried on surviving a little bit longer, but I couldn't help this guilty conscience every time I made a brocha that it might be a brocha levatolo. So one lunch I came in, I remember, and looked at the food and decided there's only one way to solve this, and I took a bowl of food across the road to my uncle who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the Leib, and I said, Reb Leib, please tell me, this is what they're dishing up across the road. Does one make a bracha on it or doesn't one? So he looked at it, he said, if you can bring yourself to eat it, maybe you make a bracha on it. I wouldn't be able to eat it. I said, that's really, now I feel a bit better, you know. I've just come from South Africa and I was feeling all guilty about feeling this way, and I asked some of the elder Bukhari and they still gave it to me. What for? They told me, if you come to Gaza to learn or to eat. He said, who told you that? Well, I said, some of the boys and the elder Shiri. So he went across and he called some of them over and he said, you know, I hear reports that the food is no good. Over Shishiva, they said, please, what do we come to Yeshiva for? To eat? It makes no difference what the food is. We're here to learn. Oh, he says, you're angels. I don't think I have place for you in my Yeshiva. I teach human beings, not angels. We see that there is this kind of feeling, this complete detachment from things material and things physical, is Catholic. It's not Jewish. A year, the Ben Torah, Talmid Chochem, has to be able to savor something delicious. He has to be able to smell something fragrant and make a brocha with pleasure and with thrill and with excitement. He's got to be able to taste something and be able to say, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam, Shakol Niyeh Bidvorei. He's got to feel it and appreciate it. Chazal tell us that when Yosef was taken down to Egypt, a miracle happened. Normally the caravans of camels used to carry hides and skins and oils in that part of the world. The Torah tells us, and for that reason it tells us specifically, the caravan which carried Yosef HaTzadik was carrying spices and perfumes and fragrant oils. And I ask you, Yosef HaTzadik had just been pulled out of a pit where he'd been spending hours or days, I don't know how long, where he nearly died, believed he was going to die. He was pulled out because he screamed and cried so much his brothers couldn't take it. They decided to send him off to Egypt on condition there was no communication ever again between him and his beloved father. He's shipped off on these camels. Does it make any difference to him whether he's with hides and skins or with perfumes and fragrances? The answer is yes. That's a tzaddik. That even in that state he's able to enjoy the pleasures of the perfumes and of the oils and of the spices. That's a tzaddik with every sense alert and awake and intense. The Telzerov gives a perush on the phrase in Tanakh of Tomim Tihyeh Mashem Elokecha. You shall be perfect together with God. And he says, you can talk about, as you can look at your motor car and you can say the engine is perfect, or you can say the upholstery is perfect. That's all very fine, but real perfection is only when the upholstery is perfect and the engine is perfect and the bodywork is perfect and the brake system is perfect and everything is perfect and works in harmony and integration one with the other. Then you can say the motor car is perfect. Says the Telzerov, you are only perfect when every part of you is attached to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Every part of you. Not only your mind is attached to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but your sense of smell isn't. Not that your heart is attached to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but your sense of aesthetics isn't. Everything has to be attached to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Your mind and your eyes and your ears and your nose, every sense, every feeling, every instinct, every intuition, all of that has to be attached to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Then you're Tomim, then you can be perfect. And he brings the beautiful Gemara, Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Kaf, which we've learned many times before. There was the case of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Imagine a tzaddik. We can't, there's no way we can imagine a Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Can you imagine a tzaddik today? Some of the great Hasidic Rabbein, sort of Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, Chofetz Chaim, Avivna Gaon, and how can we manage? Can we imagine who these people are? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, what happened to him? Shehoyo al gabi ma'ile baharabais. He was standing on a hill right by the Harabais, by the Beit Hamikdash himself. So here we have one of the holiest people that ever lived, standing in one of the holiest places that ever lived. And what happens is he's standing there. Who walks around the corner? Further on, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel would never have gone walking in places where he expected to find such things. It wasn't Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's practice to go walking along Clifton Beach in the December holidays. That's not what he used to do. But there he was. What could he do? She comes around the corner. That's not the kind of place he would expect to find her, but she's there. Morabu Maaseh Hashem. Every sense is tuned to God. The immediate reflex is to connect it up. This beauty is a creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. I can't deny the beauty. I can't say I didn't see it. I can't say it didn't impress me. So I have one of two things: to dominate it and expel it and destroy it, or I can glorify it and make a whole hedonistic experience out of it, or I can elevate it into something religion. I can bring it into something religious. I can bring it as a sacrifice. If I can take the ox into the Kodshei Kedoshim, I can take human beauty onto the Mizbeach of Avodas Hashem and elevate it to a greater appreciation of who God is and what His actions are. Marabu Maasecho Hashem. That's a Tomim Tiyeh Im Hashem Elikech. Says the Talmud Rav, there you see perfection tuned into the Ribbono Shel Olam, where every sense is alert and alive and immediately connected to God. Rav Rabbi Akiva Ro Eishes Terunsrupus HaRosha. Rabbi Akiva, he also happened to be walking somewhere and walks around the corner, and who's there? Not only is she a shiksa, but she's married. And not only is she married, she's married to a wicked man. Rok Socho Uvocha. Socho Kuvocha. Simultaneously, look at the richness of emotion. Simultaneously, Rabbi Akiva expresses and feels disgust, sadness, pathos, and happiness, joy, all at one moment. Rak, why does he feel disgusting? He looks at this gorgeous human being and he thought of her origins. What is she? Two reproductive cells, that's what it all is. Nothing but, as the psychologists say. And when you reduce a human being to nothing but, you can cry at the gap that that creates. We can be expressed disgust at the gap, what we build ourselves into, and after all we are is a bit of genetics, and this is what we build ourselves into. There's something disgusting about that. Sochak, he laughed. Dilsido de Megayra the Nosivla. Because apparently he was able to perceive with Ruach HaKodesh that she was going to convert and he was going to marry her at that very same moment. Tocho, he cried, the high Shufro Boli Afra, that such beauty is ultimately going to deteriorate, degenerate 6 feet under. Do you know what that is? Imagine seeing a tzaddik standing in tears, crying. And you say, my goodness, what's the matter? Has it been a tragedy? Have you lost her? He says, I've just seen the most gorgeous girl. So my goodness, you should have been looking. He said, I couldn't help it. She walked right in front of me. I virtually bumped into her. I wasn't looking. It happened. And you mean to say you were impressed? What are you crying about? That beauty is going to deteriorate, going to become old, decrepit, and ultimately die and decay. That's what I'm crying about. Look at the feelings of beauty. Can that compare lahavdil elef avdolis with the reaction that female beauty creates in the minds of the rotten people that walk around and read all these funny magazines and feast their eyes? Is there any way that they can appreciate beauty to the same extent that Rabbi Akiva can? Does it ever bring them to tears? Rabbi Akiva appreciates it far more than any ordinary old secular person is able to appreciate. That's Tomin Tiyeh Im Hashem Elokecha. Everything's alert. Everything's alive. Everything's awake. Do you know the story that I've told of my cousin who was engaged to get married? He was learning in Kfar Chassidim at the time. and he was going to spend the Shabbos with his kala, his kala's family. And he went to the Belia, to my great uncle, and he said, "Good Shabbos, it's Friday, I'm going to Yerushalayim, I'm going to spend Shabbos with my kala's family." "Oh, that's very nice. Where are you staying?" "He says, I'm staying with their family." He said, "You mean you're staying in the same house? You're going to be there all the time with her?" He said, "Yes, yes. Halachically, there's nothing wrong with it, is there?" "No," he says, "there's nothing wrong halachically." He says, "Just give me your name again. What's your Hebrew name?" And Rebbe starts writing with a very concerned and worried look. He says, "Yeah, Ben." And he gives him his father's name. "No," he says, not your father's name. "I want your mother's name." He says, "Your mother's name?" He gives him his mother's name. He says, "But tell me, Rebellion, why do you want to know my name all of a sudden?" He says, "You're obviously very ill. For a young man learning in yeshiva, surrounded only by other men, and learning Torah and Kedusha, to go and spend a Shabbos with his kala, and you're not afraid of the effect it's going to have on you, you're obviously very sick, and I need to daven for you, I need to be misfellow for you." That's how Rebellion saw it, as an abnormality. To be able to be exposed to the beauty and attractiveness on the opposite sex without being affected is something that my young cousin prided himself of, and Reb Elia saw as an abnormality and a sickness. Couldn't relate to it. That's not what a human being is supposed to be. A human being is supposed to be moved by these things, and that's why the halacha takes such measures to protect us from it, so that we don't become unnecessarily moved by it. But if one's confronted with it, to deny it, to pretend it doesn't exist, to run away from it, to try and annihilate it, is that called humanity? Is that called perfection? Is that called tzidkus and tzmimus? No, says it tells it off. That's not it. And so Yitzchak Avinu shows, as the Ramban says, just as a novice sometimes needs music in order to reach the nevuah, so he needs physical things, and he needs the pleasure of a good meal. And since he's going to give the bracha to his son, he wants the son to prepare that meal to establish the relationship between them. And he wants at the same time to teach Esav. Don't think that to take over from me, which is what he wants Esav to do, that's the purpose of the bracha. Don't think you have to give up the pleasures of life. All you have to do is redirect them. They have to be sacrificed. They have to be channeled. They have to be elevated. You have a strong animal inhibition and a strong animal intuition, a strong animal existence, says Yitzchak to Yaakov. You're a tzayod, you're a hunter, you're a man of the field. Don't think that that has to be wiped out and annihilated. That too can be used in the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so it is that he sends Esav out to hunt dafka. I don't want you just to go to a Mahadrin butcher and buy an animal. I want to show you that you can use your skills for Avodas Hashem. I want specifically the animal which you hunt. I want game. That's the taste I want, and that's the taste I need. And only you can do it. Yaakov can't do that. So don't feel guilty about the fact that you're a hunter. Don't feel inadequate and sad about the fact that you're a hunter, whereas your brothers are Rosh Yeshiva. You go out and hunt and use those skills of hunting for Avodas Hashem. Use it to bring a korban, use it to make a meal, which I'm going to use in turn to give the bracha that you so richly deserve in Yaakov's eyes, or that you so richly need, if not deserve. The two areas that Esav excelled were in his hunting ability. And the ability to hunt requires a certain degree of deceit and cunning. To hunt, you've got to fool the animal that you're not really there and that you're not really after him. You can't be honest with the animal when you're hunting him. And that deceit, Chazal tell us, Esav was able to use not only in the jungle but also among human beings. There is very little difference between the politician and the hunter. The one hunts animals and the other hunts human beings. But the methods are very similar. There's very little difference between the modern journalist and the hunter. They're both after the blood of the other, be it an animal or be it a human being. So many of our modern day professions are merely more sophisticated forms of hunting. And the other thing in which Esav excelled was the area of kibud av v'eim. Particularly kibud av, he excelled in the respect and awe he showed to his father. Esav was the Bechir, and therefore he was the Kohen. He was the firstborn, and in those days the firstborn functioned as Kohanim. And for that he used to use special clothes, the Big Day Kahuna, the clothes which were restricted for the Bechir, for the firstborn, handed down from Odom Arishin. And whenever he came before his father, he regarded himself as if he was coming before the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Beis HaMikdash. And just as the Kohen used to put on his special clothes for that occasion, so Esav used to put on his special clothes when he came before his father, because he realized that was a service. But he used his hunting to dominate his kibud aveim. He used his worship, and he subjected his religiousness to the mastery of his hunting. The dominant feature was the hunting. And so he used to fool people that he was more religious than he really was. He used to make himself appear, he used to hunt his father's mind by using his kibud aveim, by using his one strength and subjecting it to his other strength. And at this point Yitzchak comes and says, Esav, if you want to do tshuva, just turn it around. You don't have to sacrifice one of them. You have two strengths. You're a hunter and you respect your father. Don't subject your respecting of your father to your hunting. Rather subject your hunting to your kibud aveim. Go out and hunt for your father, for avodas Hashem, and then you will be able to deserve the brachas. Then you will be able to succeed me, even though you're a hunter. You'll be able to succeed me, and you'll become the next in the line. We'll say in the future, imagine such a thing where we would be saying Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam three times a day, Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Esav. Imagine, that's how it would have been. That's how Yitzchak perceived it. Esav, there's Yaakov the Rosh Yeshiva, there's Yaakov the Tzaddik, and who carries forward the lineage? Esav. Merely by subjecting his hunting, his politics, his slyness to Avodas Hashem. Not destroying it, not eliminating it. If God gave you that kayach, says Yitzchak, God gave you that kayach to be used. Use it, elevate it, sanctify it, and you're just as holy as anybody else. That's some kind of understanding of one angle of this parsha. Yitzchak wanted Esav to do tshuva. Yitzchak wanted Esav to merit the succession. Yitzchak felt it could be done, not by changing his personality, not by annihilating his drives and his intuitions and his instincts, but by merely using them to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Esav could become the third in the line of Avram and Yitzchak and the next generation. That's a Jewish approach. That's the Torah. We don't have weaknesses. Human beings, normal human beings, sincere human beings, good people, we don't have real failings. Our failings are merely a misdirection of powers and strengths which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. Look around, we see a lot of people sitting here. Each one is unique. Each one is different. Each one looks different. Each one sounds different. Each one thinks differently. Each one has a different blend of koiches. Might all be the same koiches. We've all got a bit of intelligence, we've all got a bit of kindness, we've all got a bit of cruelty, we've all got a bit of each of the midas. But the blend differs in every human being. We're all cooked up in a different way, and therefore we all have a different taste. But there's nothing in any of us that wasn't placed there by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. The recipe that makes us what we are was conceived of by the Ribbono Shel Olam. He made that recipe and he cooked us up. We're produced by him himself, and therefore there's nothing in us which wasn't meant to be there. You watch a lady baking a cake and you say, why are you putting this in? She says, just to give it a certain tang. You said, it's so little, if it's so good, put in more. No, she says, you put in more, it'll spoil it. You said, it's so little, surely you can't taste that. Ush says you can't. Just it gives it that little tang. If it doesn't have that, it's boring. It misses something. Then she puts in a little bit of something else. What's this? That's to give it a little bit of sweetness. He said, Mahi, you tell me that was for tang and this is for sweetness. What are you trying to make? Yeah, you need it because that blend of that tang and that sweetness gives it just the right thing. And you're saying, what will happen if you leave out one ingredient? She says, then it's a different thing. That's not what I'm trying to do. That's not what I'm trying to make. This is what I'm trying to make. And when you eat it, if one has one's taste buds developed, if one concentrates when one eats, if one uses every part of oneself as one is meant to be, as one is, as we see, if we're totally awake and alert, if all our senses are functional, we taste the tang and we taste the sweetness and we taste the spice, all these things mixed together, and we see what she did. We see the brilliance of the cookery. Really, we see the incredible genius of the proportions. And we understand that it's genius not only of the conceiver of the recipe, but also of the cook, because you know how it is with these recipes. You ask them how they make it, and they say, you put a little bit of this and a little bit of that. How much exactly? They can't tell you how much. That's the brilliance of the cook, that she knows by feel, intuitively and instinctively, just how much to put in. So it is with human beings. Everything that was put into us was put in to create effect. There's nothing in our personalities and in our characters which the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't want there, because that's what makes me me and you you. That's what makes us special. That's what makes us unique and different. And whatever it is he wants us to do in this world, he feels we need every part of that, every little spice and every little ingredient we need. And Chas v'Shalom, if we endeavor to deny a part of that, to pretend it isn't there, to discard it, to annihilate it, there's no way we can fulfill our godly function. The physical drives is put into us, the spiritual drives, the ambition, the kindness, the cruelty, everything is put into us. In exactly that proportion is there, because that's exactly what we need. The question is only, are we going to sacrifice it? Are we going to take that blend and elevate it? Or are we going to allow it to pull us down? Are we going to go chasing after the ox, or are we going to bring the ox and put him on the mizbeach? That's the question. Are we going to allow ourselves to be distracted and to be diminished, or are we going to elevate every part of ourselves and take that special blend and dedicate it towards a higher purpose? That's the question that faces us. That's the issue. There is no evil. There is no wickedness within us. The evil in wickedness is only in how we choose to use ourselves, in what we choose to do with these gifts and talents which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. Perhaps that's particularly applicable at this time, firstly before a holiday period, which, as I mentioned last night, is an opportunity for very great progress and for very great degeneration. It just depends on us. We have more time than we used to have during this period. Things are easier, pressures are off. We have opportunities, we have leisure time. Are we going to take that leisure time and allow it to slowly destroy us day by day, diminish our awareness, diminish our brightness, diminish our vivaciousness and our dynamicism, while we lie flaked out on the beach? Or are we going to allow that leisure time to be used to refresh us, to innovate us, use the time to do the things that we don't have an opportunity to do during the year, to read the books we don't have a chance to read, to study the works that we don't have a chance to study, to spend time with friends we don't have an opportunity to see during the year? Are we going to be elevated at the end of it, or are we going to be running around chasing the wild ox? And also, because as I mentioned last night, now as we finish the term, as we finish the year, we start already at the beginning of the next one. The holiday period, as I said, is not the end of this year. The year starts with a holiday. The year finishes now. This evening is our last shiur in the Beis HaMedrash for this period, for this year. And that's the end of the year. The new year starts tomorrow morning. Starts with a holiday. Start taking things easy in order to have the energy to be able to cope and face with the pressures of the year to come. And for that year, for that entire year, we need to be mindful of these ideas which I've expressed. Let nobody feel that because of my weaknesses, I'm a late starter, I don't have a background, or I spend so much of my time in my business or with my profession, that's the situation in which I find myself, or I'm in the army, or I've got other crises at home, that because of that I don't have a chance. Understand that the Ribbono Shel Olam cooked it up. He cooked it all up for you, because that's what he wants you to be. And all you need to do is to take that. And Esav the hunter could have reached the level of Yaakov in the eyes of Yitzchok if he would only have been prepared to take his hunting abilities and subject them to Torah. He would have remained the Bechor. It's only because he was unwilling to do that, and because Rivka perceived with Ruach HaKodesh that he would be incapable of doing that, that he would always regard his hunting as an end in itself, as a value in itself, that he wasn't able to achieve that. We, with a special blend of ingredients that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us, each one of us, are capable of reaching unlimited and unimaginable heights, merely by using those koiches, by keeping them fresh, by keeping them alert, by nurturing them, by continuing the blend, and by directing every single one of them to be used for furthering Avodas Hashem, for furthering the work of the Ribbono Shel Olam.